My name's John Stevens. I'm the National Director of the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches in the UK. I'm delighted to be joined by Jen Chartres, who is the Exec Director of Crosslands. Jen, thank you for coming to speak with us about leadership and particularly leadership teams and team culture.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, Jen, you've got a background in management consultancy and have done a lot of work with leaders over the years. Can you tell us a little bit about the career you've had, how you've been involved in helping leadership teams?
Yeah, thank you. I want to begin by saying I don't see myself, I'm a bit of a reluctant leader. I didn't grow up seeing myself as a leader or in a context where I had any kind of natural leadership opportunities until I reached university and got involved in Christian leadership and suddenly found there were things that needed to be done and needing to get them done with and through other people. And my leadership sort of began to emerge from there. I fell accidentally into management consulting. My husband was training for the ministry and we needed income. And so I went and got a job and this is what I happened to fall into. Thankful to the Lord for just a brilliant, almost 30 years. The work I did was initially just leadership development, and then that took me more into working with groups of leaders, that took me further into working with the leadership of joint ventures and strategic alliances. So leading a single organization is pretty challenging, but when you're leading something that consists of multiple entities and the decision-making and the power dynamics and the financials get really complex, leaders need help. And I spent a lot of my sort of more recent years in consultancy working on big alliances and joint ventures.
Yeah, and now you're working in a Christian context as Exec Director of Crosslands. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that work and the organisation that you're leading?
Yeah, so Crosslands exists to provide theological resources and training for people, first of all, on the sort of general ministry training side, for people who would never be able to get to a seminary. People stay in context and train with us through a combination of short intensives and distance learning from week to week. And more recently, we've extended what we're doing to the whole area of cultural engagement with a missional focus. My colleague Dan Strange has joined the team to help us really equip people to think biblically about the culture, not only to critique it, but also to learn how to engage it with gospel intent. Our hope is that we'll raise up people in churches and for the church more widely who can really speak into the culture with a confidence in the Bible and the gospel and all it has to say for our culture today.
You could give us a sense of the scale of the team that you're working with at Crosslands.
Oh, it's a relatively Dan. Yes, it's a relatively small team. I think we're about 10 of us in the core team, a combination of faculty and operations people. We don't make a huge distinction between those things. Obviously, their day-to-day roles and focus is very different, but we try to keep a really good connection between those. It's an ethos thing that I hold pretty dearly. More widely, we have a number of mostly pastor theologians who work as tutors with our students, and then a wider network of churches that we partner with in one way or another to deliver that. It's a very agile kind of model. We are not we're not a large sort of institutional type of organisation. We're trying to stay as fleet of foot as we can be, and just to steward well what the Lord has given us and to pursue wisely the opportunities that He is bringing to us. It's a lovely sized team to work with. It's the kind of team I've directly led most of my career. So I ran it was a niche consultancy working on some very, very big government projects, but still with a small core team, bigger sort of network of associates. But the sort of teams I have worked with and advised are sometimes running multi-billion pound contracts. So I've sort of sat across different scales and types of team. And perhaps also relevant as well is my husband's a pastor. We planted a church in the north of England 16 years ago. And that's been a constantly changing development of different teams from the very first tiny core team. And then as we've gone through different stages of growth, needing to sort of reconfigure and work differently with people. And that constant adaptation has been a wonderful learning experience.
So having had experience in senior leadership in both the secular and the Christian context, what do you think is particularly distinctive about Christian leadership?
Some years ago, a client of mine, the head of a government department, I was working on a contract that went on actually for some years, and we were out to dinner with some of his directors, and over dinner, he said to me, what difference does being a Christian person make to your consulting practice? Which is a wonderful question to be asked over dinner, and led to a superb conversation. My immediate response was, two things that stand out. One is, because I believe everybody to be made in God's image, I'm going to have a very high view of everyone I encounter. So whether it's the person doing the most menial work in the organization or the most difficult senior leader I might encounter, I regard them as made in God's image. And that instantly sets a posture towards problems and opportunities and so on. And at the same time, I know all of us to be fallen and sinners in need of grace. So the most powerful, impressive leader that I might encounter, a three-star general or four-star, may appear to carry a lot of power, but in fact, he is also a sinner in need of grace. And that removes a lot of fear. It means that I'm not concerned about how I might be judged by this very senior group of people. I'm far more concerned about my conscience before the Lord. And that is very encouraging. It makes you very courageous and has perhaps been really important to some of the really important interventions I've been able to make, the conversations I've had with some of my clients. You go with your heart in your mouth, but you know this is the right conversation to have. And I think has been very enriching to my consulting practice. So there's a in the marketplace, being a Christian person just gives me a settled worldview and a confidence in who I am and the standard against which I'll be judged, which is not what these people think about me, but my status in Christ, that just enables you to make certain kinds of ethical decisions very carefully, to think about how I deal with people. We can perhaps come on to all of this a little more. I think our Christian worldview is a theory of everything. You know, there are a lot of people who are sort of going after a theory of everything. There is such cohesion and richness and beauty in our Christian worldview that when I'm approaching the challenges and the task and the role of leadership, just acts as the most immense bedrock and framework and everything I could wish for.
And Jen, when you talk about leadership and reflect on leadership, you usually start with Genesis as your starting point. Why do you do that, and why do you find that so helpful?
The Bible starts there, so that's always a good place to start. I think there are broadly four ways in which we can be taught by the Bible on leadership. The Bible has so much to say for us. The really obvious ones are the case studies of great leaders in the Bible, and just looking at their patterns, their ways of living, the ways they handle difficult situations is, of course, valuable. But they are being presented to us as leaders of God's people, and in some cases, a type of Christ. So I want to be a little bit careful when I'm not a leader of God's people. So I kind of don't want to assume that I am like David, for instance. But that's a rich source. I think the direct instructions to Christian leaders in the New Testament, again, absolutely wonderful. And to God's people, they give us a great deal. That's really important. The Bible is full of wonderful metaphors of Christian leadership, servant leadership, shepherd leadership, and so on. And we would do well to really pay attention to those. Again, the starting point or the heart of those is the leading of God's people. The reason I start in Genesis 1 and 2 when I'm reflecting on leadership is that there are just fundamental patterns in those opening chapters and verses and chapters of the Bible about who God is and how he has made the world, which set up a worldview that apply to every single one of us and have a lot to say about leadership. So I feel that as a, I'm not an elder, I'm not a pastor, but I am a Christian woman seeking to play the leadership role God has given me. And I just feel that I can have a real confidence about starting there without drifting into sort of aspects of a leadership role that are not for me. Just to think about Genesis 1 and 2 a little bit, you know, it starts with who created. In the beginning, God created, and God is Trinity. So right from that outset and all the way through Scripture, we've got unity and diversity, one and many, God, and God who is both love and power. And that just sets the scene. And then how he creates by speaking and by defining things and differentiating things one from another. And I think that's a really important thing that we need to learn how to do in his image. He creates space and time. And we can perhaps come back to the importance of space and time for us to think about as leaders. He creates male and female, and there's diversity and difference. But also, two other things. We are called as humanity to fill the earth and subdue it. There's a cultivation mandate in there. And I think a lot of leadership is about cultivation. The definite sort of formal definitions of leadership is often about taking a group of people from here to there. But in fact, when people talk about their experience of leading and being led, a lot of what they pay attention to is what the experience was like, what the culture was like in that team I worked in. And so there's definitely an aspect of leadership. A definition of leadership is what sort of conditions I'm creating for the people who I'm called to lead. And I think all of that's there in Genesis 1 and 2. And then finally, the other thing I'd just pick out here is that we're made with limits. You know, it's this beautiful picture in Genesis 1 and 2, this richness, this abundance in creation. All of that's there except that. And right from the outset, to recognize our limits, our constraints, our finitude as human beings seems to me also a very, very important mindset and posture to have when we go into leadership. Where it takes me to is the importance of collaboration, not trying to, you know, pursue a world domination strategy, but to pursue well what the Lord has brought me into leadership of, for example. So that was a very long answer to your question.
Jen, just thinking, the Bible obviously has a lot to say about leadership, but there are also lots and lots of secular theories of leadership that I know you've engaged with. Can Christians benefit from those? How should we regard secular theories of leadership?
I'm delighted that there's so much good material about out, but we do need to have filters switched on. There's so much common grace in that material. I think one of the questions that we should be asking and perhaps don't do enough of is where has this construct or framework or sort of management model come from? Broadly, two ways. One, some come from ideology and some come from empirical research. And just doing a little bit of digging into the name behind the model, you know, who did this work and why did they do it and where did it come from, is very, very wise. So that's a really key differentiator. It's worth people recognizing that an awful lot of what's around in the management and leadership literature, particularly in recent years, comes from a secular humanist and a Buddhist worldview. Even that doesn't make it completely worthless, but we've got to be very careful about some of the assumptions that lie beneath that. But with those filters switched on, you know, you don't have to be a Christian to observe the world as God has made it. And there are some just wonderfully rich and powerful ways in which people have observed what happens in organizations and in leadership behavior and turned that into a conceptual model that can be really helpful to us. I think in general, one other comment is that with secular leadership models, there will always be at least these two limitations, I think. They will never understand human sinfulness sufficiently, if at all. So there's always this hope that you can kind of, you know, achieve a lasting ideal. You know, if you do these three things, you'll fix your organization. We've got to understand our fallenness and go about solving problems or setting things up with the acknowledgement that creation is subject to decay and groaning, and that often feels like that in organisational life. So we don't have a low enough view or a careful enough view of that. But at the same time, we don't have a high enough view of humanity, in the sense that it's often very much about how we can get people to do what's needed for the organisation's benefit, and we'll often not pay enough attention to the flourishing of individuals within that. So that's not an exhaustive list, but perhaps a few things to point out, to say, love those models and embrace them if you've done enough work to understand where it's coming from. One of the things that models do for us is they provide a lexicon. They offer language that a group of people can share in order to explore and examine and understand and work on a problem. And, you know, just like in Genesis, things are named, and that becomes really important. If we can name what's going on in an organisation with the help of some of these models, it often gives us a better ability to then make good decisions about what to do about them.
Thank you. Let's move on to begin to think about team culture. We're talking about kind of team culture. Do you want to tell us what you mean by team culture, and how would you describe the positive culture that a team ought to have?
Yeah. Pretty much everybody knows the sort of very familiar of culture is the way we do things around here. Of course, in biology, a culture might also mean the conditions in which certain things grow. And you can't do culture as an organizational leader. You get culture as a result of the way you do a whole lot of other things. That's not the same as saying you can't be intentional about culture. You can be very, very intentional about the kind of culture you're creating. But you build and establish a culture through the way in which you use various things, and I'm kind of back in Genesis 1 and 2 here, things like how we use space. You know, do we give people enough space to work, or do we cram them into a tiny office? And what does that say? You know, what sort of environment and conditions do we ask people to do their work in? Time is a sort of fundamental factor in the creation of a culture of an organization. So how we vary the pace according to what we're trying to achieve, what sort of pattern of the day and the week and the year that we establish. We can be very intentional about doing those sorts of things. The biblical quality of time is very intentionally nuanced. There's a kind of architecture of time that God gives his people. And as leaders, we do well to pay attention to how the architecture of time that we're building into the way our organization runs and so on. Just a small thing on time, for example, if I run meetings where I value those who speak up the most quickly, then what I'm saying is I place more value on quick thinking than on reflective thinking. If I want people to have thought about something, then I want to give them the sort of key things to think about ahead of time, because some of the most reflective people will bring better answers after a time to consider a question. So it's a really small thing. Just my posture as a leader. I mean, most of us know when we've been led how much we read from the way the leader of our group or team or community reacts to things. Their levels of anxiety is just very easy to read. It's a very hard thing to sort of fake. So your presence is just very visible to people and communicates a great deal and impacts on culture. And then another thing that I think is just so powerful in the creation of culture is what gets tolerated. It's not the only thing that creates culture, but it's a very significant contribution to it. If lateness is always tolerated, then it says we don't value one another's time. If aggressive behaviour is always tolerated, then we say we don't really believe that God's people should be patient and kind and forbearing with one another. And so, as a leader, you know, it may be really uncomfortable sometimes to confront certain types of behaviour, but I have to be willing to do that if I'm not going to be condoning things that could be really damaging to the culture.
So for leaders, what would your advice be to them about how to create a positive culture? What steps should they be taking to address cultural issues?
This is very simple. Widely used in the world of coaching, there is something called the GROW model. The GROW stands for goal, reality, options, and the will to act. And that applies to lots of things, not just culture creation. But the goal step is about saying, what is it that we want to have happen here? What sort of culture do we want? And often dealing with that in relation to quite specific things. You know, our meetings are just not very functional. Well, okay, let's articulate how we would like it to be. What would good look like? It would be a very helpful thing. Even in a home, you know, as our kids get older and we realise that mealtimes have become a bit of a battleground, and that's a cultural thing in the family home. Let's pause and say, goal, what would good look like? How would we like family mealtimes to be? So when we've got a sense of that, and often that can be in itself a very rich and helpful conversation with the team, we then dig into the reality. You know, what's actually going on now? Let's describe in quite specific ways. You know, what's going on is that we all arrive home stressed at the end of the workday, and so, you know, getting the family meal on the table is fraught. Guess what? The oven's broken, so that's a problem. So I'm using a very simple example, but there are often multiple factors that feed into why that pattern has become established and needs to change. And so understanding those realities of the cultural thing that you're seeking to address, and then the options. That's what it says on the tin. It's what possible things could we do, change, enact. You know, let's get the oven repaired. Let's cook for the week ahead, whatever it might be, so that we create the conditions in which we can sit down and have a family meal that is respectful of one another and glorifying to the Lord. And then the will to act is actually what are the specific steps that we're going to take. So. That's a very, very simple approach to the whole thing. That's when you're specifically wanting to intervene in a pattern of culture to change it. But we can't be paying attention to all of those variables all the time. That would just become exhausting. I think underneath it all, there is so much for us to pay attention to in just our intent as leaders, which comes right back to this question of how do I see people, and what am I trying to reflect about the Creator, about my understanding of humanity and people's worth in the culture I create. And if I'm carrying that question around with me, actually that feeds through to decisions and actions and behaviours and reactions almost unconsciously. And people see it and notice it.
Are there any specific things you've done or invested in as executive director of Crosslands to try to create the culture within your team that you'd like to have?
Small things. One is that we really make an effort to try and get together. We're a distributed team, and it would be, the easy thing to do would be to sort of leave people in their various locations cracking on with the work that they do. But setting aside time, which includes time to go for walks and have meals, not just to do the work, has been vitally important to us, particularly coming back from COVID, and the team has grown in that time and doing a reset. The way we run our residential intensives with students is really important. We've gone out of our way to try and keep a sort of kitchen table feel. We hire these big houses that sleep sort of 30 or 40 people. We involve students in helping to prepare and clear up for meals. And the faculty can be found in the kitchen. And that seems enormously important to me, that, you know, these people who our students look up to as writers and theologians and so on can be found washing the dishes or helping to chop the onions. And, you know, some may say that's not very good use of their time. We don't use a lot of their time for that. But there's something about saying that nobody is above this. I will make sure that I am, in there helping to cook and clean up and so on. It's fine. So it's often these quite small things that matter most.
And sadly, we all know that not every Christian, every team has a positive culture. Cultures of teams can become dysfunctional. What are the key ways you think that a team culture can become kind of unhealthy? How do we avoid that happening?
I think letting things go or pushing aside discomfort about things is a really harmful kind of tendency if that's the case. We mess up as leaders, right? You know, I might be really tired and respond irritably to something or misjudge a situation or, you know, mess up a piece of admin. I did that just last night, which causes other people problems. I might speak harshly because I'm really passionate about something. The question is not do we ever mess up as leaders, but what happens next? First of all, if I notice it of myself, I want to be quick to acknowledge and repent and own my behaviour and make sure it doesn't become a pattern. Sometimes I'm not going to notice that. And the question is, am I creating an environment where people feel safe to call me out on that? And in our organisation, annually, there's a specific way of people feeding back on me to our board chair, I think I sincerely hope that you know my colleagues would pull me up on things, but those who have oversight and responsibility for an organisation, I'm a board member of various organisations as well, and I have a board overseeing me. Those in positions of oversight must be willing to see and say when it's not healthy. I think it doesn't need to become a crisis. We've got a lot of sort of almost crisis type of situations around. And one of my desires, wishes, would be that we could have a much lower bar around calling attention to cultural things that are just not quite right. Not to bring a leader down, but to actually help that situation to become more healthy. And so it's really incumbent on me to make sure that if I am called out, I respond really well, that I get curious about why that landed so badly, or, in myself, why did I behave that way in that situation? And to be willing to show myself to be able to address it. Because if I do that once, then it becomes much easier for people to say when things are not quite right. And I'd love that to be the case for us in Christian organisations.
Thank you. I would imagine quite a lot of Christian leaders haven't given a great deal of thought to how to develop the culture of their teams. It's not perhaps something that they've ever been told they need to do, or that they've realised that they need to do. What advice would you have for leaders to just help them to be able to grow in their skills in these areas? What should leaders be doing to, in a sense, be able to cultivate a good culture within their team?
One of the most underrated skills, there are two skills I keep coming back to as being underrated leadership skills. One is the ability to ask good questions. And the other is the ability to be a good observer and reader of rooms and situations and people. And that doesn't, some people that comes really naturally to. I have to say, I don't think that's particularly, you know, in my 20s, I wouldn't have thought I was particularly good at that. I just realised it was a really important skill set, and so have worked away on that. And sometimes a good framework, again, coming back to, you know, framework helps me to sort of put what I'm seeing into categories and language that allows me to articulate what I'm seeing. So if once you've seen it and being able to name it, you can then start to do something about it. And so, for example, a leader gathering a group of people together and saying, what are the words we would use to describe our culture right now, would be a very simple exercise and very, very revealing. And it doesn't need to be a major sort of crisis point to bring you to that, or a huge exercise, just over coffee, you know, what are you seeing in our patterns and culture as an organization right now? So use other people to help you see them and articulate them, because once you see them, you've got more choice about what to do about them. And the questioning skill that I mentioned absolutely feeds into that, framing good open questions that don't presuppose an answer will serve you a long way. In that.
Jen, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your insight and your experience with us. Thank you.
It's been lovely. Thank you.